anesthesia enthusiasts, and welcome to this month's episode of Style Points. Today, we've got an episode geared towards one of my favorite groups of people, medical students applying to residency in anesthesiology. Even if you aren't a medical student, though, I'm hoping that this episode provides you with an inside look at what it takes to become an anesthesiologist. Before I invite my fellow associate program director, Dr. Dustin Satoris, on the podcast, I'm going to turn it over to Nate, who will be introducing this month's RSI, which, of course, stands for Resident Selected Information.
Thank you, John. Delivering our RSI is CA1 resident Ann Burgess. Ann was a college burn ball champion, which she described as an incredibly dangerous game of hockey without ice skates. If a burn ball trauma victim rolls into your ED tonight needing ventilatory support, you're in luck because Ann is going to teach us about ventilators. Welcome, Ann.
The learning curve for new trainees is steep in the operating room as well as the intensive care unit, especially when throwing around terms like BCAC, SIMV, SBT, RISB. What do they all mean? How do I use them? Learning how to navigate the modes of mechanical ventilation can often feel overwhelming. So let's get into it. The goal of mechanical ventilation, in very simplified terms, is to provide oxygenation and ventilation. Patients may require mechanical ventilation for a whole host of reasons, from routine general anesthesia in the operating room to dire respiratory failure in the ICU. Regardless of the reason for requiring mechanical ventilation, the basics of vent management forms an important backbone of our practice in anesthesia. Some of the variables that we can manipulate when programming and adjusting the ventilator include the FiO2, positive end expiratory pressure, otherwise known as PEEP, respiratory rate, and tidal volume or inspiratory pressure, depending on the ventilatory mode. FiO2 and PEEP will generally be adjusted to achieve oxygenation goals. Respiratory rate and tidal volume comprise minute ventilation and will therefore be adjusted to meet various ventilation goals. There are a couple of main themes within ventilator modes. We tend to use either volume or pressure as an independent variable, meaning you can decide to set either the volume or the pressure you want delivered, and the ventilator will figure out where to set the other one. At the same time, there are modes that account for patient effort and those that do not. Volume-controlled ventilation delivers a set tidal volume with each breath. This is great for ensuring consistent tidal volumes and therefore a consistent minute ventilation. However, the mean airway pressure is generally lower than it is with pressure-controlled ventilation, which can lead to less effective oxygenation. Pressure-controlled ventilation delivers a breath until a set pressure is reached. This helps limit barotrauma, but tidal volumes can vary, leading to an inconsistent minute ventilation. However, mean airway pressures are higher in this mode, resulting in increased alveolar recruitment, therefore increased oxygenation. Note that both of these modes have control in the name. This means that the ventilator has full control of the patient's breathing. If the patient tries to take a breath on their own, the ventilator will not allow it. This is great for fully sedated patients or paralyzed patients, but this can lead to coughing, bucking, more formally known as ventilator dyssynchrony, if the patient tries to take a breath of their own while in these modes. In contrast, pressure support ventilation is entirely patient-triggered. Each breath is supported with a preset driving pressure. This is a great mode for ventilator weaning, but can also be dangerous if a patient stops initiating their own breaths. Assist control is more of a hybrid mode. Every breath is supported, whether initiated by the ventilator or the patient. This mode can be tacked onto volume control and is very common in ICUs, as it will deliver a set volume when the patient's initiated a breath, but also have a backup minimum respiratory rate if the patient is not breathing at a rate greater than what is programmed on the vent. Synchronized intermittent mandatory ventilation, or SIMV, also combines mandatory breaths with spontaneous breathing. It will deliver a fixed volume when the patient does not initiate a breath, but in contrast to assist control, it will only provide pressure support to patient-triggered breaths. Choosing the right mode depends entirely on the patient's lung mechanics, mental status, and underlying pathology. Other variables like type of procedure or patient positioning may also contribute towards choosing one mode over the other. So when do we know that it's time to stop mechanical ventilation and extubate? We look at a couple different areas when considering extubation, especially in the ICU, including lung mechanics, mental status, and the patient's overall clinical picture. A spontaneous breathing trial, or SBT, is the clinical test that is used to assess a patient's readiness for extubation in the ICU. In order to perform an SBT, patients will typically need to be on minimal ventilatory settings. This varies from institution to institution, but tends to be an FI below 30 or 40 and a PEEP of 5 to 8. The SBT is typically performed by the respiratory therapist, and they will place the patient on pressure support for at least 30 minutes. The SBT can be stopped earlier if the patient isn't doing well. We then look at a few factors to decide whether the patient can be extubated. Typically, we will assess the patient's ability to maintain oxygenation by looking at the SpO2 or formal blood gas. In order to assess the patient's ventilation, we'll calculate their RSBI, or RSBI. The RSBI is the Rapid Shallow Breathing Index and is calculated by dividing their respiratory rate by the tidal volume. If a patient is breathing fast and shallow, their RSBI will be higher. This tells you that the patient may not be quite ready to be extubated. We typically use a threshold of 105 as our upper limit of an extubatable RSBI, although some recent evidence may suggest that the trend in RSBI may be more indicative of success than one standalone value. It isn't a perfect measure, but does provide some objective information about a patient's chance of success post-extubation. Ultimately, the decision to extubate does not rely solely on the SBT and your RSBI. Patients must also be awake, following commands, clearing their secretions, and be able to protect their own airway. Pristine lung mechanics on its own does not guarantee that they are safe to be without a protected airway. Hopefully, this helps give you a foundation for discussing these patients and demystifies the black box that is a ventilator. Happy venting and SBTing!
Dustin Satoris is an associate professor at the University of Cincinnati, and we are actually both associate program directors here at the University of Cincinnati as well. We're here to talk about applying for anesthesiology residency, but first, Dustin's going to give us some of his pro tips about how to remove a ring from your finger in the perioperative period. Dustin?
All right. Well, thank you for having me. so that's a little bit of a story based on what happened when I was running the board the other day for the hospital that we work at. And all of a sudden, my hand started swelling. And what started out as a casual idea to potentially remove my wedding ring that I've had on for 16 years turned into a relatively emergent situation as my finger began to swell pretty rapidly. But, you know, thanks to John Crow and a few other of my helpful associates, we were able to use an emergency ring cutter, and then ultimately
we used, I think, 4 or 5 different emergency ring cutters.
Yes, that's right. And then to my dismay, a very large bolt cutter to finish the job. But all is well. I live to fight another day, and I do not have to apply for disability. So that's good.
Thank goodness. I did think that we were going to have to prep one of the ORs for you at one point in time.
I remember I initially wanted to save it, and we tried the little trick where you put the floss wrap around, and I think you only get really one shot at that because it's pretty aggressive, and it starts to the swelling cascade a lot more. So when that didn't work, it was the writing was on the wall.
We have a lot of people that are pretty good at removing rings. In fact, we have to do that to prevent burn injuries to people's fingers in the perioperative period. That's why we have people take off all their jewelry. But despite all of our expertise, this one was a particularly challenging one, I feel like.
Yes, but again, you know.
I can still see on your finger where.
Oh, there's no escaping. There's no escaping the fact that I've been married for so long. Happily, I must say. But yes, it... the swelling is still there, but it's healing slowly but surely.
Well, I'm glad. Well, what we're actually here to talk about today is applying for anesthesiology residency.
Yes.
Dustin, how long have you been an associate program director?
So I've been an associate program director since 2017. And then even before that, I was involved with the process as a chief resident. The year before that, or a couple years before that, actually. And then again, like probably many of the people listening, I was involved on the other side as an applicant. So, you know, that's something we all share. So we all have, hopefully you're not so far removed that you don't remember what it's like. And I think that provides, you know, a lot of structure to that hopefully will provide a lot of structure to the talk today.
Do you think that it's easier or harder than it was when you were applying for residency?
It's harder. And I think it's gotten a little more competitive, for sure. I think there is definitely a larger eye on anesthesia as a great specialty and a great career that that people have tapped into. I think like everybody else, you look at the applicants, if you're privy to them, and you say, well, man, I don't know if I would have been able to match at this point in time if I was going up against all these wonderful applicants.
Yeah, it's really kind of humbling when you're going through all of these different applications that are dramatically better than at least mine was, probably not yours, but they're definitely a lot better than mine. And thinking to yourself, wow, it's really kind of a privilege to get to pick out the people who we get to interview and who we get to ultimately match to our program.
Right. Absolutely. And I think the big kind of overarching thing to remember as a medical student or anybody involved really is that, you know, by and large, everyone's already made it to medical school. They've already had success in medical school. They've already, you know, when you're applying to residency, you've already realized such great successes in your life that that it's just inherent to the process that you're going to be presented with a ton of wonderful people who've done wonderful things. And that's ultimately a great thing for the specialty because we're all going to be colleagues someday.
So let's put yourself in the shoes of a medical student who's maybe a second or third year medical student somewhere in there, and they have just decided anesthesiology is definitely the thing for them. Maybe they spent some time shadowing you and they figured out that's who I want to be when I grow up. Where do you go from there? How do you build a CV? How do you make it so that you are someone who the program directors will look at and say, that's the guy that I want at our program?
So finding mentors is really important, and finding people that that have gone through the process. That could be students that are above you that have just done it. It can be faculty at your home institution. It can be people at other institutions. But certainly finding mentors, I think, is the first step. Really asking as many questions as possible and getting a really good understanding of what the specialty is really like, not only as a trainee, but also as a faculty member eventually. So that's the step. That's the first step. And I think from there, you really want to look at all the different things that make your application whole.
First off, when we're talking about mentors, how do you find a good mentor? What kind of person would you be looking for? What kind of characteristics? Do they have to be an anesthesiologist, do you think?
I don't think they have to be, but certainly that helps because they're going to be keenly aware and understanding and, you know, understand the specialty. It needs to be somebody who you potentially see yourself in or who you jive with, somebody who you get along with, somebody who you can tell maybe has your best interest at heart and is not doing it for other reasons. That's the first step. And then you're going to have a better outcome, I think, if you pick somebody in anesthesiology because that person is going to understand the process.
Yeah, I've found that to be true as well. I've definitely had some mentees talk to me before about other mentors' advice that they've given, and I've thought to myself, oh wow, that's actually not correct, and I can tell them definitively that it's not correct because I'm an associate program director. I'm the one who's looking through the applications and
right.
Can help pick things out. That doesn't mean that you have to have somebody who's a program director as one of your mentors necessarily, but it definitely does help to have somebody who's gone through the process themselves. I think I agree with you.
Yeah, I think earlier on, we had some people here at our home institution who had been advised by somebody who wasn't in anesthesia. And I think fortunately, they found some people in our department and we were able to kind of give them the correct information. I remember some of those stories distinctly.
So what makes an anesthesia application stand out? If we're looking through hundreds or even thousands of applications, what's going to make someone stand out?
The last few years, it has been thousands. So
it has been.
Yes. So I think what you have to remember is when you're presenting an application, just like any other any other marketing professional, you become a marketing professional for that small period of time, right? And my wife is a creative director, so I know this, uniquely well. But really what you're doing is you are telling a story. Just like somebody might be telling a story about a product, you're telling the story of your life and your professional life. And there are a few key things that you have to hit, but really providing a well-rounded story is the key to having your application get noticed. So I'll go into some like specifics.
Please do.
First off, academics. You need to do well in your classes, and it's important that you have kind of handily handled the rigors of medical school. Residency doesn't necessarily get any easier, nor does being a junior attending. So, you know, having that where you confidently completed medical school is a really good thing to see. Letters of recommendation. Having good letters of recommendation is great. Now, what does that mean, right? A good letter of recommendation. It means somebody who knows you well, somebody who has some insight into your character, and potentially has some more than surface level interaction with you, ideally over a long period of time. So for some people, that's an anesthesiologist. For other people, that's a pediatrician. Or maybe an advisor that you had all through medical school. It can be anybody, but it's going to be best if you have at least some letters of recommendation from an anesthesiologist.
I've read through, again, thousands of these letters of recommendation. They fall into a few categories that I've seen. Would you agree with me that about 85 to 90% of letters of recommendation are almost exactly the same?
Yeah, they follow a cadence. So they follow a little bit of a cadence. And you got to think that if you are a faculty member who is writing a lot of these, there has to be some type of kind of prescribed way of doing it so that you hit all the points, hit all the high points, the style points, if you will. And then you want to make sure that you are speaking the language that is going to resonate with the people reading the application.
So who would be a good example of somebody who could write a great letter of recommendation? And maybe what are some characteristics of some letter writers that you don't think would do as good of a job writing a letter of recommendation?
That's a great question. So I can give you a personal anecdote. So I had a letter of recommendation, and while you're not, you know, you waive your right to see your letters of recommendation, but I'm very confident that one of my best letters of recommendation was from a pediatrician that had a pretty prominent role in the patient safety sector at Cincinnati Children's. Now, I had no interest in being a pediatrician, and you know me very well, and that's not where my my aptitudes are necessarily. I like I like being a dad, but I don't like being a pediatrician.
Me too.
Yes, and I'm confident that that was a great letter. I had great interactions with this person. We had talks outside of just medicine through my 2 months that I was there, and I had him all 2 months. So that's a pretty long period of time as a medical student. So I think that that is, you know, again, longitudinal interaction with something beyond just surface level academic interaction, I think is great.
I had a similar sort of a story. One of my letter writers was a neurology professor. And I, again, had no interest in neurology, but I do remember being on that rotation and dealing with some people who were newly diagnosed with ALS. And it was quite an emotional thing to be there while these people were being told that they had, you know, this disease process that's ultimately terminal.
Right.
And being there
through those situations, talking to the patients through those situations, and the professor had seen me in those kind of critical situations, I think helped him write a really nice letter for me.
Absolutely. That's a, I mean, very parallel type stories. You know, you're going to get letters from the chairman of the department oftentimes, or a program director of your home institution.
The chairs write all those letters personally by hand, I understand.
Yes, with papyrus and a quill pen. Yes. But no, it's, you know, it's a kind of something that sort of has to happen and it needs to be there. That's not to say that some of them aren't personal. Some of them can be very personal.
That's true.
But you have to imagine how many those people are writing. So, you know, you still got to go through the motions and get those letters if you're applying, but, you know, finding at least one or two letters from somebody who knows you really well is really the key.
Also, you definitely need to have some anesthesia letters as well. I think it's probably a red flag if you don't have any letters from an anesthesiologist.
100%. 100%. Because, you know, that shows that you have done some due diligence in actually talking to somebody in the field.
So let's move to personal statements.
Yes.
This is always a very challenging issue with personal statements. One of the things that I wanted to offer to whoever is listening is I remember writing my personal statement, went through a whole bunch of edits. I thought that it was great. I submitted it. I got into residency. But when I was advising people and editing their personal statements years later as a program director, I kept coming across some of the same themes. This is a little bit too cheesy. You're not putting enough of yourself into it. And so what I eventually did is I looked back at my own personal statement, and I was somewhat unsurprised to find that it was just as bad as everyone else's.
Oh, yes. Hindsight is 20/20.
And so what I did was I saved my old one. I edited my old one, knowing that it isn't for anything now, but I made it much, much, much better from the perspective of a program director. So I have a before and after that I'd be willing to share with anybody who is listening to the podcast if they want to see the example of what a normal personal statement looks like versus what I think a pretty decent personal statement looks like. So if you're interested in that, you can just email me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com.
That's very interesting. I remember writing mine and thinking it was good at the time. I haven't done what you've done and looked back at it. I'm sure it's horrid, but
it was just cheesy.
I did take a chance and really not mention anesthesia. It was really all about playing soccer, which actually does become somewhat of a theme where people talk about something that was like big into in their life growing up or whatever. You know, personal anecdotes about interactions with medicine, maybe from the patient side, or pivotal cases that they experienced that maybe were like a thunderclap moment where they decided they wanted to do anesthesia. I see that a lot too.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of different themes in personal statements. People will draw out extended metaphors about how anesthesia is like sailing a boat or like climbing a mountain, and I think that's fine. I think that falls within the 85 to 90% of personal statements that are, again, sort of like letters of rec. They fall into kind of certain categories, whether it's telling a personal medical story about how they became interested in anesthesia or in medicine in general, which was mine. I had my back surgery back when I was 15 or 16, and that was sort of what I have come to view as more of a turning point in my life that pointed me towards medicine and ultimately anesthesia. Or, you know, you can draw upon whatever experience in your life has brought you to where you are. The one thing that I definitely recommend to people in their personal statement is read it out loud to yourself. And if you think to yourself, I sound really cheesy and I don't like how I feel when I'm reading it out loud, rewrite it. Try again.
Yeah, don't be afraid to start over.
Yeah, use more natural language like you would actually tell somebody. Don't use words in your personal statement that you don't use in real life is something that I will often tell people.
That is very, very good advice because, you know, ultimately, again, you're trying to tell a story and someone needs to be able to read your story and needs to be able to, you know, remain involved and interested in what you're saying. One thing that's interesting, I think, about personal statements that we should probably mention is AI.
Oh, and, yeah, for sure.
And ChatGPT and the like. In the future, I'm sure that this is going to become rampant, and identifying it is going to, I will bet, be much more challenging over time, that it's going to be challenging. So figuring out a way to write your personal statements such that it is absolutely guaranteed that you are writing it yourself and not having, you know, an AI-based program write it, I think is going to be good. The converse is, if someone finds out that you are writing it with an AI-based program, I think that that would be a major red flag.
I think so too. But I think that what a lot of people are using AI for is not necessarily writing the entire thing and submitting it as is. They're using it as more of a mentor, as a creative editor, somebody who can put things in a little bit better language. You know, after all, as medical students, we're not really trained as creative writers or marketers. We're trained as medical students, as doctors.
That's right.
Right. So I think it's reasonable to use resources at your disposal to use AI to help edit things, to help give you ideas. But doing the whole thing for you, I think it's just going to come across as extremely generic.
So 100%.
I think the best prescription I have for personal statements is just be radically honest, not just with who you're writing it to, but with yourself. Why are you really interested in it? What is driving you? Where are you coming from? The best letters of the best personal statements that I have read have just been radically honest and get to the heart of why that person wants to do anesthesia. I think one other thing we should mention is the last paragraph, which has been more frequently co-opted than ever. Can you talk about what the last paragraph of the personal statement should be? Whether it should be personalized per program?
It seems like this is something that is being taught, but I'm all for it. The last paragraph seems to be some type of tie-in where you tie in your experiences to what you want to do in residency and potentially in your career. And it also gives you an opportunity to personalize it to whoever you're applying to. And I see that not infrequently where people personalize it. And that's actually a really powerful tool that you can have, because you're like, just, you know, everybody's human. And when someone is personalizing it seemingly to you, that is something that you gravitate towards. That's a very, common human emotion is, oh, they like me. I like them too. So that's a nice thing. Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of personal statements over time, and I've seen a definite trend towards the personalization of the last paragraph. You know, with the signaling now, there's really only about 15 programs that people are applying to very seriously. And with those 15 programs, you know, if you're applying to 50 programs, I think it's pretty impossible to write a personalized personal statement to 50 programs.
And fraught with potential error.
Yes, with catastrophic error. If you accidentally copy and paste the wrong thing, it can be a...
That's a kill shot.
Yeah, that's bad news. But seeing why the person is interested in your program beyond just, oh, your program has a lot of liver transplants, and I think that that's really great. And it's like, okay, that's fine. But if they have a real reason why they want to come here, for example, you know, I really like your program, and, you know, my sister lives here in Cincinnati, and I grew up just across the river, or I have a specific reason why it's not just your program, but it's the city, it's the culture, it's everything. When you have something more compelling like that, I think that can really help you out.
I agree with that. I think that it's your chance of tying it all together. The one last thing I'd like to say about personal statements is, what I ask myself after I read one is, or not what I ask myself, but what I want to hear after I read it is, man, I have to meet this guy. I have to meet this girl.
Absolutely.
That's the key, is I want to meet this person. Like, listen to this story. I need to meet this person. And that's all you're trying to get across in the end of the day. You got to get to the next stage.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not just about the personal statement and the writer's rec. We also have to do well in your classes. And let's talk about the importance of step scores, too. We don't have a step one score anymore to look at. That's gone away.
No. And honestly, objective data that we have when you look at dean's letters from medical students or from medical schools and everything, a lot of things have been going to much more of a pass-fail type system. There's a lot less objective data. And, you know, chiefly step one being away is a good example of that. But this makes it pretty onerous when you're trying to compare people across different institutions. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I think that the elimination of step one has put a huge burden on students to do really well on step two, because that's the only one with an objective score attached to it.
Right.
And while previously, you know, if you did less than your best on step one, but everything else in your application pointed to you being a stellar student, but you just had a bad day, which can happen. We're all human, right? Well, you had a chance to redeem yourself on step two. That no longer exists.
Right.
So I think it's a little unfortunate how it's being done now. But it does, you know, inherently show that the importance of kind of really studying, playing the game, and doing very, very well on step two.
What about class rank? What do you think?
Class rank is more of an objective longitudinal view. That's another thing to say, actually, is that even though you might be pass fail in your classes with what you get on your transcript, that doesn't necessarily mean that the school itself is not keeping track of people in terms of putting them into quartiles or quintiles or whatever. I think we do look at that, and I think that that's important. It demonstrates kind of longitudinal achievement and achievement in other disciplines. I really like it when people do really well in subjects that are not anesthesia.
Right.
That means that they're trying their best through all facets of their education and really trying to, you know, kind of suck the marrow from the bone, no matter where they are. And I think that that's extremely important and shows a lot of character.
Yeah, I agree. It's really nice to see when you can see demonstrated across their application and all the different facets. This person was trying hard no matter what situation they were in, even if they were on a rotation that they should have no reason to care deeply about. It's just the type of person that they are. It's part of the story.
That's right.
So let's talk about one other thing in terms of the application. One of the things that I've seen on people's applications recently and has gained more importance with the elimination of step scores is the research aspect of it. How do you do research in anesthesia? How do you make that part of your application stronger? Is it important?
So, like most good questions and most stellar answers, it depends.
Right.
Yes. But no, I think research is important. It's not something that is mandatory. I will say that. When you're looking at extracurriculars, and research, I think, is included in that, research can be everything from clinical research to bench science research to quality improvement projects to patient safety research. There's a lot of different avenues that you can take that your institution might be involved with that you can also get involved with. Certainly, you know, checking the box is less important than having a tangible position or a tangible experience within that body of research. So now I know medical students don't have all that much time, right? So you don't have all that much time to be involved. But with the time that you do have or over a longitudinal period of time, I think that that's kind of more important. And certainly you'd like to get something out of it in terms of a publication, whether that be a poster presentation or an abstract or something. We certainly look at those things and see if people are involved with and contributing to the anesthesia literature and to the academic nature of anesthesiology over their short career.
One of the things that has become more important over time is finding ways to separate one medical student from another. Now, if your College of Medicine has decided we're not going to give grades to anybody, we're not going to rank anybody, we just think that everyone is wonderful who graduates from here, and that's what we're going to put forward. It makes it very hard to tell one medical student from another, and it makes it very hard for those medical students to show that they're the kind of person who is going to blossom in residency. So one of the things that we look at is how much have you done in terms of your publications now? It's become more and more important. Do you need to be excellent at doing research to be a great anesthesiologist? No, but it sort of is a replacement for effort. You know, do you need to know all the stuff on step two to be great anesthesiologist? Also, no, but it sort of describes how much effort you're willing to put into things by studying hard for that test. And it describes how much effort that you're going to put into things if instead of having one case report, you have maybe 10, or you've done multiple posters and you've gone to multiple conferences. It just shows the amount of effort that you're willing to put into things on top of getting good grades, getting good step scores, everything else.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that that's a good way of saying it.
Overall, when you're looking at an application, how long does it take you to go over one of these applications?
It's a trick question because there can be things in your application that make me look at it for a very short amount of time, certain potential red flags, which we can get into later, actually.
Let's do red flags now.
You want to?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So some red flags would be, failing your board exams altogether.
Sure.
That's usually a red flag.
Is it possible to get over that red flag?
It is. I think almost everything is... nothing's insurmountable, completely insurmountable, but certainly it can create an uphill battle for you.
Sure.
So that's one thing. We can go extreme. Felony convictions.
Sure, yeah. If you are a felon that has taken a lot of drugs and killed people, I think that that's probably not a...
It's tough. It's going to be an uphill battle, as we say. Yes. So
it's going to make it harder to get into anesthesia.
That's right. There are, some things that you might not think about, like risky behavior.
Oh, okay.
Like demonstrated risky behavior, such as, say, you're a climber, a rock climber, but you only like to free solo.
Oh, yeah. That does sound dangerous.
It's dangerous. It shows potentially too dangerous for a field that is, rooted in patient safety and anticipatory awareness and ensuring that we are kind of actuarially responsible for risk in the operating room.
Climbing a high mountain without safety gear is sort of the opposite of the way that anesthesiologists think.
Yes, that's exactly true. So those are kind of things that you just need to at least think about. An incomplete application. So an application that is put together haphazardly is a complete red flag. Don't have your letters of recommendation. Don't have a personal statement. Your personal statement is in many different fonts with a lot of different... with lots of grammatical errors and spelling errors and a CV that is not formatted correctly. All of these are like low bar things that everyone should be able to do, that there are resources there to do. And to your point, there are, even if you don't have personal resources, there are technological resources available to you that should kind of go without saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You shouldn't be the only pair of eyes on your application. In fact, there should be multiple pairs of eyes from you, your mentors, your friends. You should be making sure that nothing sticks out, nothing is strange.
That's right. And, you know, back to your first question, when you're looking at all this stuff, you know, you get really good at being able to look through this very quickly, right? And a lot of the programs that you submit them to organize it in such a way that allows people to kind of get an overarching glance very quickly, which is nice. That being said, to truly go through an application, you're reading the personal statement, reading the letters of recommendation, literally clicking into people's transcripts and looking through their grades and things like that. This can take 10, 15, 20 minutes per person. Mm-hmm. So it's an arduous task. And if you're really doing a holistic view of someone, as we do, you really have to look at everything, because the key is to try to find, if there is an admonishment somewhere, you have to find the outlier. You have to find out if the admonishment is the real story or if that is the outlier.
Right. I've spent sometimes up to an hour looking at somebody's application before, because there is something like a red flag, but there's also things that just make you want to interview the person as well. You know, maybe somebody took a year off of medical school for some reason, and that's reflected in their transcript. I want to find out that story. Why did they have to take that time off? What's going on with their lives? Does that make them a threat to not be able to complete residency, for example?
Which is what we're looking at in the end of the day, is right. The ultimate goal is for us to recruit people who will ultimately be successful in completing residency, attaining board certification, and becoming a productive member of the anesthesia community.
I totally agree. One of the things that I've tried to emphasize to people who are filling all this stuff out is the three characteristics that I think that program directors look for. And you can also chime in with what you're looking for as well, or see if you agree with me. We're looking for people who will work hard, will pass their boards, and lastly, won't cause any issues during residency.
Domestic strife, if you will.
Well, it could be that. It could be a lot of different things. You know, I've heard of residents who get felony convictions during their residency, or who have to drop out for a variety of complicated reasons, which is never great. We're here to help people succeed at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I mean, we're all people, and, you know, people make mistakes, and the goal is to, you know, get through with as few mistakes as possible. But, you know, ideally, you know, part of, you're going to find a residency program that will support you when you're down, just as much as they're going to support you when you're up. I think we actually do a really good job of that. I'm very proud of that, is that we have our residents' backs, and I think that that's extremely important. But yes, you're absolutely right on the money with that.
So let's talk about away rotations. Should people do away rotations?
Sure. Why not? Next question. No, I'm just kidding. So away rotations are, it's a double-edged sword, right? If you don't have a good anesthesia rotation at your institution, then you should absolutely do an away rotation to get the full Monty. There's really a couple reasons to do one. If there's a particular program that you are very, very interested in, then that's a very good reason to do an away rotation there. If there's a rotation or an away program that offers you a learning opportunity that you would otherwise not get, that you think is going to make you a better clinician, that's a good reason to do an away rotation. I don't think people think about that as much, but I think that that is a really good, whether that's transplant or trauma or some other type of niche thing. I think that that is a good way to do an away rotation. But you have to remember, when you do an away rotation, that is effectively a month-long interview.
I've talked to medical students who are on their away rotation, and they have expressed to me as I'm mentoring them and such that they're really nervous about the interview that they have coming up. But I tell them not to worry about the interview. The interview is right now.
It's already happened. For better or worse.
Right. Everyone has already formed their opinion of you because you've been here for a month interacting with us. One 15-minute slot, you know, a week after your away rotation is likely not going to make a huge difference.
No, it doesn't. What I will say, though, is that somebody who does an away rotation, does a stellar job on their away rotation, and then absolutely mails it in and doesn't give any, doesn't place any importance on their actual interview, their actual one-on-one time with different faculty members, that's in some ways a little bit of a red flag.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that that's pretty rare to see that.
It's almost never, but it you shouldn't take for granted any opportunity you have to put your best foot forward.
Sure. What tips do you have for people who are on their away rotation? How can you succeed, stand out in a positive way?
Talk to your talk to the residents. See how they can be an advocate for you. Find out. It's very apparent which teaching faculty are in and around the residents. Latch on to them. Go talk to the residency program coordinator and say, hey, which faculty really enjoy being with med students? And seek those people out. It's important to get as many stories about the program as possible. Like it or not, you know, we're talking about how we look at applicants, right? But it's just as much applicants interviewing us as it is us interviewing applicants.
Oh, absolutely.
And by and large, the way the residency match is structured, it is people are in an advantageous position, and it gives deference to the applicant, and you know they're choosing us as much as we're choosing them. So, you know, it's important for somebody who's on an away rotation to get the full story about the program that they're at too.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's definitely one thing that I would go into my interviews thinking about is not just that I'm being interviewed by the program and then are going to ask me what my favorite tree is. Or that was actually a literal question that I got on the interview trail.
What is your favorite tree?
Yeah, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be?
Interesting.
Yeah, I know. I'm not much of an arborist, so that isn't really my field of expertise. But I think that a lot of places will ask you kind of oddball questions just to try to get a sense of who you are, what you're thinking. Speaking of which, I have a question for you.
Go for it.
If you could have dinner with anybody, it could be somebody who is from the past or even from fiction, who would you have dinner with?
That's a very good question, and I know this question well because I know you asked this to people or have been known to in the past.
Don't give away all of the secrets.
I won't give away all the secrets. So it would be my grandfather on my mom's side. I never met him. He was the only grandparent I never met. He was the one that, ironically, people say I'm the most like. And I would love to meet him and hear his story. Family's important to me, and I think that there'd be no better person to have dinner with.
So whenever I ask that question during interviews, a lot of what I'm looking for isn't necessarily that you can come up with some more interesting historical figure or person that you really want to meet and that piques my interest. It's not a guess what I'm thinking. What I really am trying to do is find out what you care about. And what you were just telling me is that you care about and place emphasis on your family. That's one of your values. And I think that that's good information for me if I was picking somebody out for the program, is to find out what their actual values are. So yeah, that's why I asked the question.
Absolutely. One of the biggest things that I look for when people are applying, and especially when they're interviewing, is and we talk about this, is a sense of grit.
Right.
Sense of grit. What does that mean? It can mean a lot of different things. It can mean that you've, you know, persevered in the face of adversity. It can mean that you just have a wonderful sense of self-control. There's a lot of different ways of defining it. But it's one of those things when you know it, when you see it. And that's always a big plus when you see that for people.
Yeah, I seem to recall there was an application where I saw that somebody's house or apartment had burned down in the middle of medical school. And I saw that they told a little bit of that story, and they still didn't miss any time in medical school and kept going through their rotation and did well in their rotation. It's like, wow, I don't think I could have done that. That would be an example of something that shows grit. That being said, if Dustin and I find a lot of applications where their houses burned down, I think we'll probably
statistically impossible. I remember one where somebody, the first sort of two sentences of their personal statement was something along the lines of like I was seven and it was my job to, you know, retrieve the bread. And to do that, I had to run across an active, like, war zone.
Right.
Every day. And I'm like, oh my God, my problems are so insignificant. You know, it's just like a complete, it's just a complete other solar system of life. And it's great to hear those type of things. It's great to hear those stories. And that was, he could have written, I can't remember if it was a he or she. I think it was a he, but he could have written about anything else for the last, and those two paragraphs, or those two sentences, already made me want to meet that guy.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's a heck of a hook.
It was a good one.
So there are some people who are going through the couples matching process where they're trying to both match to the same city, or maybe they're applying to different specialties, but they're trying to match into the same place. And they have something in place for that with a couples match where people can end up going to the same place, or they can try. Do you have any advice or recommendations for people who have gone through that?
It definitely adds a layer of complexity. You kind of have to do a little more research as to the competitiveness of both fields at that point, that the people are applying to, and figure out who's driving the bus, because in some ways, if the competitiveness is completely disparate between the two people, one person is going to really be the one that is the key driver of where they're going to be getting interviews. So that's kind of the first sort of step, is to figure out how competitive each applicant is in their respective specialties, and how, when you combine those two, what the probability is that you're going to be successful in matching. And then you have to do a lot of legwork as to where you need to apply, what programs are potentially located close to each other, so that you aren't separated by 2,000 miles. You know, that technically wouldn't happen with a couples match, but or shouldn't happen. But that is the I think that's where you start, is you have to really have a good understanding and a lot of self-reflection on your competitiveness, and realize that you might have to apply to more programs just by definition because of the added layer of complexity.
As somebody who went through the couples match myself, I can confirm that it does add a layer of complexity. We had a big, colorful spreadsheet that we use to keep track of everything. And it's hard. Everything tends to run together. It's expensive, too, to travel around. But the good news is for now that COVID has sort of made everything virtual, so it's a lot less of an arduous task to get to all these destinations.
Although I think we might be getting back away from that eventually again.
It's
up in the air.
It's up in the air. We'll see. We'll find out which way the wind blows as far as that goes.
I understand both sides of it. I understand and sympathize with the fact that it's an expensive, stressful process for the applicants, and that a virtual component is extremely helpful from a financial aspect and from a logistical aspect when you're potentially on a rotation that is hard to get away from. But I also understand how important it is to see places in person, you know, walk, touch, feel, be a part of that institution. Even if it's for a small period of time, you can really get a good sense as to the camaraderie, collegiality, and general themes that run through a place.
So what do you think about second looks then? Is that sort of the middle ground that people can go and see after their interview is already done?
Well, that's become our middle ground, and I think it's a good one. I think you should, if you go to a place in the virtual, in the virtual space, quote unquote, and you love it, you have a great interview, I think you owe it to yourself if you're really considering spending four or more years of your life at a place to go see the city, go see the institution. If they offer a second look, you need to try to be there. If you're serious about it, there's no reason to go on every second look because, again, that's too arduous of a process. But if you are dead serious about going to a place, going on a second look is important.
Yeah, absolutely. Should people be concerned about the way they present themselves at second looks? Is a second look another interview? Can it move them up or down on the rank list?
Well, I can't speak for every institution because I don't know how other people do things, but the way that that I think is the correct way to do it is to already have all your decisions made, already have all your lists completed, so that it is not something that can move you up or down a list or change someone's opinion or outlook on you. And I think that's for two reasons. One, you're just there as a guest. And two, not everybody might have equal resources to come do a second look or have the availability to do it. And just because someone wasn't able to do it doesn't mean they didn't want to, and doesn't mean you, and certainly means we shouldn't hold that against them.
So let's wrap up here and get your style points overall. What style points or points of personal preference have helped you throughout your career? And maybe we can even say through the application process and through becoming an anesthesia professional.
The best thing that someone can do and the thing that's been, most useful for me is no matter what the circumstance, always coming into work, trying my best, being a team player, and trying to get the most educationally and professionally out of each situation. I think that, oftentimes a question that we will get in the interview process with people who don't have any frame of reference really is like, what do you look for in an applicant? And I always tell people I would look for the same things that I would look at for an anesthesia resident as I would look for as a manager at a bank or a front of house representative at a restaurant. And that's someone who is a team player, someone who tries their best, someone who operates with professionalism and puts others before themselves, puts their patients above all else. And if you do those things, you're going to be successful.
What did your wife say when you told her that you had cut your wedding ring off at work?
She looked at it and said, "Oh, great. Is this like some type of omen or foreshadowing event?" And, you know, mind you, we've been together since we were 17. We met at Blockbuster Video, if people who are listening even know what that is.
Wow.
But it's a stupendous situation. I told her that I already had a like a silicone ring in the mail to appease the situation, and it ultimately was fine, as I knew it would be.
Good deal. Well, Dustin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this month's episode of Style Points. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen. If you enjoyed what you heard, please consider leaving a review. I'm hoping that this podcast gets popular enough to serve as the ultimate source of truth and joy in the universe, so every 5-star rating and review helps with that. As always, you can contact me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. Take a deep breath. Open your eyes. We're all done. Now you know.